Hello, and welcome to another MHP podcast. Today, I am joined by Dr. Arouk. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. I'm Calvin Tompkins, and Dr. Arouk is our new pediatric gastroenterologist, and we're very lucky to have him in the area, and we appreciate your bringing the GI program back to life.
Very good. I'm really glad to be here. I've been enjoying the entire region of Western North Carolina, especially Asheville, and all of what it has to offer.
Great. So there is a chronic abdominal pain co-management guide up on the Mission Children's Toolbox, and today we're just going to spend a couple minutes to discuss the content of this guide. So why don't we dive right in? In the background section for the chronic abdominal pain, you distinguish between organic and functional abdominal pain, and I think this is the understanding of this is probably pretty good amongst providers. Do you use this language with families?
I actually do. We run into this question quite frequently in our GI practice. So I usually tell the families that. I use the terms organic and functional, and then I explain to them that, for example, when we are looking for an epigastric pain or dyspepsia, we perform an EGD, and statistics actually exist. 80% of the time, we do not find a tissue problem, and 20% of the time, we find a tissue problem, such as an ulcer or changes in the esophagus mucosa or celiac disease, for example. But 80% of the children who have dyspepsia do not have changes in their tissue. So I tell them those 20% of the children actually have an organic etiology, and the 80% of children who had a normal endoscopy have a functional disorder. And then I go into details what functional disorder means.
Right. Great. And within functional GI disorders, you include functional abdominal pain, functional dyspepsia, and irritable bowel syndrome. Tell us what distinguishes these three entities and what the current thinking is there.
So we usually utilize in our practice the ROM4 criteria. It's a symptom-based criteria that puts functional abdominal pain in certain categories, and it's the fourth version of the ROM criteria, so the functional GI disorders 3 is branching, and currently the biggest two players in the pediatric age is the functional dyspepsia and irritable bowel syndrome. When we look at the definition of both entities, the functional dyspepsia and the irritable bowel syndrome have a lot of similarities. I think the biggest difference is the location. Functional dyspepsia would be dyspeptic pain that is happening in the epigastric area typically, and it can be associated with things like nausea and effortless emesis. Irritable bowel syndrome, when I think about it, it's more that the pain that happens in the periumbilical area, and it is associated with a change in the stool pattern, either constipation in 60% of the children who have IBS, diarrhea in 30% of the children who have IBS, and 10% of the IBS patients alternate between constipation and diarrhea. Functional abdominal pain used to be the umbrella that hosted all of the functional abdominal pain subcategories, but now it became a separate entity where the child has an abdominal pain, but the abdominal pain does not meet the symptom-based criteria for functional dyspepsia nor for irritable bowel syndrome. But they have features of both. And in that situation, right now we are using the term functional abdominal pain. All three categories actually share the same characteristics of chronicity and impact on life. Also, when we look at those three separate categories, there's also small, minor to major variations in how we approach treatment for those different conditions.
Okay, great. And you mentioned chronicity there. The term chronic it is tailored to what specialty and what condition you're speaking about. And so with regards to functional abdominal pain, what's the definition of chronic?
That's correct. And in most of the conditions of functional GI disorders, the chronicity is defined by 2 months. So that's kind of the timeline that we look at when we mention chronicity in a functional GI disorder.
Okay, and symptoms at least weekly during that period.
Correct.
Okay.
Once or twice a week.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. And then you list a number of red flags here. Help us prioritize these.
I think this is one of the things that I utilize pretty much in every patient. Appointment in every new patient appointment of any child that I have referred to my practice. I think it's a simple, very useful screening method. I put a list of a bunch of red flags that I look at, but the major three ones that I focus the most on is unintentional weight loss, recurrent unexplained fevers, and blood in the stool. Now, I try to separate between blood mixed in the stool and blood with wiping or blood covering the stool because part of the patients we are looking at have either constipation and or irritable bowel syndrome, constipation predominant, and those children not unusually have some rectal bleeding, especially. Either covering the stool or blood that they see when they wipe. But blood mixed in the stool is definitely a red flag.
Okay, great. And then moving down here through social, lifestyle, and family history, I'm just seeing that there must be a pretty established genetic etiology with regards to inflammatory bowel disease, peptic ulcer disease, and celiac disease.
That is true, and some of those conditions, such as inflammatory bowel disease, we already know that there's at least 160 gene locations associated with inflammatory bowel disease, and we know those, and the list is growing. Celiac disease, we also know the gene location that's associated with celiac disease. Some conditions, we know they run in families, but we do not know yet the actual genetic association that with a particular etiology. For example, peptic ulcer disease, we know that it runs in families, but we do not know of a particular gene that's associated with it.
Okay, great. And then in the initial management section, you list a number of familiar laboratories studies here. What would be your threshold for a primary care provider to have these studies performed?
I think if a patient meets one of more of the red flags that we mentioned in the previous section, then they definitely deserve further evaluation. To start with the screening labs, and then further evaluation with endoscopy or imaging might be necessary as indicated. Now, if the patient has the chronicity, but they do not meet any of the red flags and they meet the ROM4 symptom-based criteria for functional GI disorders, it is not inappropriate to start treatment as a functional GI disorder. And in my practice here in Asheville, I feel that some of the families actually prefer the approach, again, in the absence of red flags, to attempt to try the condition, the functional GI disorder, first, and see if the child has improved, and then follow up and reassess improvement and whether evaluation for an organic etiology is necessary or not. And again, in the absence of red flags, I think that's a very acceptable approach.
Okay, great. And I'll just point out here that there is a link for the ROM4 criteria embedded in this co-management guide. So with regards to treatment, give us an understanding. And how do you explain the current understanding of functional abdominal pain to patients?
That's an excellent question. A lot of times, patients have expectations of an organic etiology, and when we want to educate them that the child actually does not have an organic etiology and have a functional GI disorder, I find that using certain terms is more helpful to explain to the family what's going on, and it sets up the provider for better chance of success in treating that functional GI disorder. So I think it is important, for example, never to use the term "it's in their head." That always is a counterproductive statement. In addition to that, I feel my approach is to acknowledge the pain. The pain is real, and I feel that it is important to also educate the family that the child actually have a diagnosis and we know what it is. So I use the term, we know what the problem is, it has a name, and this is the name. For example, irritable bowel syndrome. And then, and this applies to all the functional GI disorders, we know the nature of it. And when I say that, I say it's going to come and go, and it's more likely to come back when you're under emotional or physical stress. Then we try to identify precipitating factors that makes the abdominal pain return more often and see how we can address that. In addition to that, reassuring the family that this functional GI disorder is not an organic disease and it's not going to leave health consequences. So I use usually the term cancer. I usually say this is not cancer, and if you do not treat it, it's not going to make you more likely to get cancer. But we like to treat it because it's giving you disability, and we want you to be able to live to the full potential of your age without needing to miss, you know, school days or your favorite sports practice or any extracurricular hobbies that the child is participating in. And then the last part is where I go over management and I say we know how to make it better, and I offer the family the available treatments for children under 18 years of age. And we know that cognitive behavioral therapy based on studies is the most effective treatment of functional GI disorders, and we have an excellent behavioral health team in Mission Children's Hospital, and I work with them closely, and I feel that they are comfortable in providing cognitive behavioral therapy to the children who have functional GI disorders. And we have a growing arsenal of treatment options that are not only cognitive behavioral therapy. We have self-hypnosis, we have medications, probiotics, de jure is still out. I'm aware of one placebo-controlled study where VSL-3 showed improvement in irritable bowel syndrome. But further use of other probiotics for functional GI disorders, as of yet, we don't have enough placebo-controlled data that makes a difference. In addition to that, we have different medications. First lines, we use TCAs and gabapentin, for example. And second line, we use other medications that that is more specialty-based. Other options include things such as peppermint oil has been tried for irritable bowel syndrome, and it also showed improvement compared to placebo in children who had irritable bowel syndrome.
Okay, so I'm just imagining those medical treatments that might be an option for a patient with whom primary care has been working and still the symptoms or the severity is problematic.
That is correct. Again, in the absence of red flags, if the primary care physician made the diagnosis of functional GI disorder, I think the easiest first-line approach is go over the education steps that we went over, and then I believe it's appropriate to emphasize the importance of cognitive behavioral therapy, and that can be a first-line awaiting a referral to pediatric gastroenterology. And if it takes care of the problem, then further management might not be necessary.
Yeah, hopefully, and probably in most cases. Well, this has provided a lot of detail for a fairly wide kind of scope of symptomatology. If providers do have questions about whether their particular patient meets criteria for a referral or not, can we contact your office?
Oh, absolutely.
And discuss prior to the referral?
Absolutely. They are welcome to contact my office. I'm available to provide any guidance regarding any particular patients, especially if their appointment is scheduled a few weeks down the road. Right. I'll be more than happy to help by telephone in the interim.
Okay.
All right.
Super. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And I appreciate your insight into this these conditions.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Okay, great.
Sorry, I don't know the number of my